Greetings, listeners. My name's Andrew, and with me is John Lander. In this podcast produced by IPAN, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, we examine the growth of legislation severely restricting our democratic rights to freedom of speech and assembly, and we then consider the history of Australians using non-violent mass civil disobedience to challenge and defeat such attacks.
We have never lived in an Australia where true freedom of speech and political action can be practiced. Former Prime Minister John Gorton is reported to have said in 1968 regarding the anti-Vietnam War protesters that, quote, "We will tolerate dissent so long as it is ineffective," unquote. In response to the recent political dispersion of a Sydney rally opposing the visit to Australia of Israeli President Herzog, during which police appeared to use protesters as punching bags, Sydney criminal lawyer Nick Hanna said in a podcast interview, and I quote, "We don't have a constitutionally enshrined right to free speech in the same way that they do in the United States. What we have here is a very limited form of freedom of speech, if you can call it that. It is the implied freedom of political communication, which has severe limitations," unquote.
Nick Hanna went on to say, and I quote, "That is why there has been a long time push for a Bill of Rights or some other legislation for amending our constitution so we have greater freedom when it comes to our ability to communicate about political matters. But that movement appears at the moment not to be in a good position, and the needle has shifted in the other direction," end of quote. He pointed out that truthful statements cannot be used as a defence against the new hate speech laws, saying that truthful statements like Zionism is a form of racism, Israel is carrying out a genocide in Gaza, Israel is an apartheid state, and Palestine should be free from the river to the sea could see you potentially arrested, charged, and facing jail time.
The attacks on freedom of political speech and action intensified after 9/11. With the enacting of draconian anti-terror legislation in Australia. Ben Saul, Professor of International Law at the University of Sydney, commented on this legislative onslaught, saying that, quote, "The truth is that Australia already has enough laws to deal with terrorism. Since 9/11, the Parliament has been amongst the most hyperactive and invasive counter-terrorism lawmakers on the planet. Much of it is never used or goes too far, from preventive police detention to ASIO's incommunicado detention of non-suspects to control orders," unquote.
Professor Saul continued, and I quote, "The new laws also go too far. They criminalise innocent travel to places the foreign minister does not want you to go. They criminalise free speech. They criminalise whistleblowers and the media that report them. They allow mass surveillance of innocent Australians on the internet. They deny procedural fairness. They violate the right to social security and therefore potentially leave people destitute. All of this comes without the binding human rights safeguards that every other self-respecting democracy imposes on its security agencies."
Further restrictive laws were passed in several states to stop environmental protest action. For example, in 2018, the Council for Civil Liberties in New South Wales stated, quote, "On July 1st, new regulations will come into effect, granting the New South Wales state government incredibly wide powers to disperse or ban protests, rallies, and virtually any public gathering across approximately half of all land across the state. The Council for Civil Liberties strongly opposes these regulations, unquote.
The ABC reported on the 12th of February 2026 that days after the Bondi massacre, the government passed laws giving police the discretion to ban authorised public assemblies a fortnight at a time for up to 3 months following a terror attack. Protest groups are challenging the law underpinning the prohibition, which has been extended 4 times already.
Ben Saul, in his other capacity as the UN Special Rapporteur on Counter-Terrorism and Human Rights, wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald on February the 10th that New South Wales has some of the most draconian protest laws in the democratic world.
It seems the government is concerned about growing community opposition to the AUKUS War Pact and the massive military build-up it entails, such as the stationing of US and UK hunter-killer submarines at HMAS Stirling in West Australia and the basing of US B-52 bombers at RAAF Tyndall, because it has formed a new Australian Federal Police Command specifically aimed at anti-AUKUS protests.
Former Senator Rex Patrick wrote in Michael West Media on January the 5th, 2026, that the new Australian Federal Police AUKUS Command has been established with little fanfare and is headed by the AFP Assistant Commissioner Sandra Booth. He said that the AUKUS Command has established a rapid response capability and is prepared for public order management operations.
Rex Patrick further wrote that, and I quote, officers in the AUKUS Command are trained in rapid appraisal, coxswaining, jet ski operation, remote piloting of aircraft and countering remotely piloted aircraft, protester negotiation techniques, protester removal techniques, and what is called public order management munitions delivery.
Public order management munitions delivery refers to the supply, distribution, and deployment of specialised, allegedly less lethal, equipment to police and security personnel during demonstrations, occupations, and other forms of protest. These public order management munitions include pepper spray, tear gas, rubber bullets, smoke grenades, flashbangs, and firearms.
Australians have shown courage and persistence in the face of anti-democratic laws restricting freedom of assembly or freedom of speech, and, where necessary, have engaged in non-violent mass civil disobedience to challenge and defeat such laws.
In 1977, the then Queensland Premier, Joh Bjelke-Petersen, declared that, quote, the day of the political street march is over. Don't bother to apply for a permit. You won't get one. That's government policy now. In October 1977, thousands of people defied this edict and gathered in Brisbane for an anti-uranium march. That afternoon, 418 people were arrested and Queensland's Right to March movement was launched, with civil liberties demonstrators continuing until the ban originally enacted to curb a growing anti-nuclear movement was lifted 2 years later.
One of the largest campaigns in defiance of unjust legislation was the May 1969 mass mobilisation demanding the release of Clary O'Shea, the Victorian Secretary of the Tramways Union, who was jailed for contempt of court when his union refused to pay fines imposed under the anti-union penal powers legislation. 1 million workers downed tools for a week until O'Shea was released. this massive strike action was illegal, with the unions and workers being threatened with even heavier fines and jail if they remained on strike. They knew this, but much work had been done educating union members on the consequences of the penal powers and, coupled with their experience, courage and confidence in the collective strength, the workers proceeded undeterred. O'Shea was released and the penal powers, as then constituted, became a dead letter and were never used again.
There were numerous acts of civil disobedience in defiance of the National Service conscription laws in the late 1970s, in the late 1960s and in the early 1970s. At that time, a newspaper advertisement was placed in a major Melbourne daily. It called on young men not to register for National Service, a Crimes Act offence, which carried a jail sentence because it urged the breaking of a Commonwealth law. Nevertheless, over 1,000 people signed that public act of defiance, including workers from all walks of life, ministers of religion, trade union leaders, and even some politicians. But no one was ever arrested or charged.
On May the 8th, 1970, 100,000 protesters sat down and occupied the central streets of Melbourne in protest against the Vietnam War and conscription, despite being told not to do so by Victorian Premier Bolte. This was an unprecedented act of mass civil disobedience, and again, no one was arrested or charged.
Draft resistors and their supporters publicly burned their call-up cards and their National Service registration forms. Both of these were Crimes Act offences. This defiance was so widespread that very few were caught and punished, and it all added fuel to the fire. A mood of rebellion was in the air, which couldn't be quelled, and which led to the December 1972 election of the Whitlam ALP government. The new government quickly abolished conscription, released jailed draft resistors, and brought Australian troops home from Vietnam.
It's worth looking more closely at non-violent mass civil disobedience. Well-known successful examples are the Gandhi-led civil disobedience campaign that brought independence to India and the 1960s US civil rights movement led by Martin Luther King. US political scientist Erica Chenoweth, in her 2020 study titled The Future of Nonviolent Resistance, observes that, and I quote, "Nonviolent resistance is a method of struggle in which unarmed people confront an adversary by using collective action, including protests, demonstrations, strikes, and non-cooperation, to build power and achieve political goals. Sometimes called civil resistance, people power, unarmed struggle, or nonviolent action, nonviolent resistance has become a mainstay of political action across the globe." Unquote. There are significant historical precedents worldwide for the effectiveness of mass nonviolent civil disobedience in directly addressing government injustice and oppression.
As we've discussed today, we in Australia have our own history of successfully defying and defeating oppressive and unjust laws. Current anti-democratic laws restricting freedom of speech and assembly cry out to be broken, and mass non-violent civil disobedience beckons.
That brings us to the end of this IPAN podcast. Information about IPAN's aims and activities can be found at our website, which is www.ipan.org.au. That is www.ipan.org.au. Good day and thanks for listening.